Here's a really special deal on a great product from our friends over at Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. You can now receive a $39 bottle of artisanal fresh pressed oil free if you just pay $1 to help cover shipping. And there's nothing else you must buy now or ever. It's a wonderful opportunity because with olive oil, my number one rule is the fresher, the better. That's because the olive is a fruit, and olive oil is actually a fruit juice. Like any other fruit juice, extra virgin olive oil is at its glorious peak of freshness, flavor, and nutritional potency when fresh squeezed. And that's what's missing with so many supermarket olive oils. After sitting on the shelf for months or even years, they've lost their freshness and can't compare with just pressed EVU shipped direct from the new harvest. Here at Milk Street, we really like these oils' vibrant, grassy flavors, as well as the intoxicating aroma, just like a garden in a bottle. Prove it yourself with no obligation to buy anything ever. For your free $39 bottle direct from an award-winning artisanal farm, go to getfresh177.com. That's getfresh177.com. One last time, getfresh177.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, for our recipes, culinary ideas from around the world, or our latest cookbooks. Now, here's this week's show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball.
맛이라는 거는 그냥 입에서만 이렇게 마시는
You have to taste the flavor with your whole body. In order to feel the whole taste, you need to open your five senses.
That was the venerable Chung Kwan, a devout Zen Buddhist nun from South Korea. She's appeared on Chef Eric Repair's cooking show, Avec Eric, and is now regarded as one of the world's top chefs. I'll be speaking with reporter Jason Strother later in the show about his visit to her temple. But first, it's time to head into the kitchen at Milk Street to speak with Raina Javeri about this week's recipe. Raina, how are you?
Hi, Chris. I'm well.
I just got back not too long ago from northern Thailand, Chiang Mai, and a guy called Andy Ricker lives there part-time just outside of town. And we spent a day going around to different restaurants, which was great. But the next day, he gave me an 8-hour cooking lesson, which I desperately needed because I didn't know that much about Thai cooking. And among other things, we made fried rice. I was really fascinated because fried rice is simple, but it has a really sophisticated flavor if you do it the way he did it. So he used a wok, of course, and I would guess we probably are not going to use one here. So what have we done to the recipe once I brought it back to Milk Street?
So most cooks don't have the wok set up that Andy has in Thailand. So we actually modified this recipe using a nonstick skillet, which most people here have. We also love this recipe because it uses day-old rice, which is a great way to use leftover rice, which means you can make a lot and have it be tasty the next day as well. We actually love the flavor of jasmine rice, which is really aromatic, but you can also use long grain white rice or basmati rice for this. But you really have to use cold rice, and day-old rice is best. If you use hot or warm rice, the result is clumpy and gummy.
Just what you want for a delicious, quick supper on a Tuesday night. So I remember he used pork belly as the meat to flavor it, which you can get here, but it's not as common as it is in Thailand. So what do we use?
We actually used pancetta, which is much easier to find over here, and it's quite similar to pork belly. We tried bacon, but we didn't like the smoky flavor of bacon. So pancetta is similar to bacon in that it's cured, but it's not smoked, so it took away that smoky flavor that we didn't like.
So you could use an uncured bacon, though, too, which is not smoky.
Sure. If you find unsmoked bacon, you can use that in a pinch, too. We did prefer pancetta, but you can use that as well. So for our sauce, we combine fish sauce, soy sauce, water, and sugar together. And you want to make sure you use a really good fish sauce, like Red Boat.
You know, I just learned recently that fish sauce is actually made from fish.
I'm kind of a little slow. Surprise.
Surprise. It's made just from anchovies, and it sits up to a year in a barrel. And the premium sauces like Red Boat, it's like the first pressing. The spigot's at the bottom. It comes out. It actually doesn't taste very fishy at all.
It's the Evu of fish.
It's Evu of fish. And if you buy any other brand, just look on the side. You really shouldn't have any other ingredients, essentially just anchovies.
Yep.
So there you go.
And then the next thing we do is in the skillet over medium-high heat, we cook two lightly beaten eggs and then the pancetta. And then we take both out of the pan, after which we add the aromatics. Scallion, shallot, and garlic. Add back in the cooked rice and then the sauce and add back in the pancetta and egg. It's really quick.
So it's obvious this is a really quick supper. It takes 15 minutes to make. It has lots of different flavors in it, which I really like. But the secret is to have leftover rice. It's not just a convenience. It's essential.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Thank you, Raina.
Thanks, Chris. You can find all of our recipes at milkstreetradio.com.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Let's take some of your cooking questions next with my co-host, Sarah Moulton, star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals and author of Home Cooking 101.
Hi, welcome to Milk Street. Who do we have on the phone?
Hi, this is Drew Land from Lincoln, Nebraska.
Wow, cool. I've never been to Nebraska. So you have a question for us.
I do. So I like to make French toast for my kids in the morning, and I always put cinnamon in it. But the problem is, because of the oil content in the cinnamon, it tends to float on the top. So the first few pieces of French toast get lots of cinnamon, and then the rest don't. And I was wondering, is there some way to incorporate that better into the milk and egg mixture, or just dust it on maybe after I dunk it?
You know, I used to make French toast for my oldest girls when they were growing up for breakfast. I did breakfast and the walk to the bus stop. You know, I must have done that 100 times and the cinnamon floated on the top. And I never thought about it until now. It's like, okay, good point. I don't know, sprinkle the cinnamon on after it's done is probably the best.
Or cinnamon sugar.
Cinnamon sugar would be good, yeah, at the end.
And do they have maple syrup with their French toast?
Yep.
Because maple and cinnamon is a wonderful combination. I would just sprinkle cinnamon sugar on top because I just don't see any other way around it.
Okay.
Yeah, the cinnamon's just not going to mix in. The water, which is the milk, whatever you're using. And that's
okay.
A good point. It's like the light bulb just went off. Ka-ching.
Or you could try another herb like ground cardamom, you know, which is sort of in the same pocket but not as oily.
No. Look, here's the deal. I have a pancake recipe I've used for like 30 years to my kids.
Don't change a thing.
And every couple of years, like I try to change. I add a little cornmeal to it. They immediately know.
No.
If I go from half a teaspoon of vanilla to like 3/4 teaspoon.
Uh-oh. Yeah. Okay, Dad. Don't mess with it.
Don't mess with kids.
All right.
Breakfast.
Okay, back to the cinnamon sugar idea.
Forget the cardamom.
All right. Yeah. Okay. All right. Never mind.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Julian.
Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Hello. Who's calling?
Linda.
Hi, Linda. Where are you calling from?
Madison, Alabama.
How can we help you?
I am having questions about vinegars. I was given some bottles of flavored vinegar. I was very excited at first and all the things I could do with it. And so then I really could only think of vinaigrette. And so I was making salads like they were going out of style and got kind of bored of that. And looked online, really couldn't find anything to do with these flavored vinegars. And so I went and got them out today. And I got one of them out. And there was like sludge in the bottom, so I'm shaking it up, getting it mixed up and stuff. And the other one didn't mix up at all. It was kind of like gelatinous.
That's called a mother. That's the culture that turns whatever liquid it was beforehand, usually it's wine, into vinegar. There's nothing wrong with it. Well, at any rate, how do you like these vinegars straight up? I mean, do they taste good?
They're not bad because that high alcohol, you know, the vinegar, 8%, is kind of, it's sharp, but it's flavorful, and both of them are very fruity. One is passion fruit, and the other is raspberry. I started out with probably about 12 to 16, so I probably have about 6 bottles left now.
Okay, it's time for my theory.
Yeah. What?
He's going to tell you. My wife taught me this theory. If you go to a store, don't buy something, if it's a piece of clothing, that you wouldn't wear out of the store. The same thing is true in the kitchen. If you open the door and you have a product there and you go like, I'll use it later. No, done. I mean, just get rid of it, use it up. Because otherwise, 2 years from now, you're going to have 40 bottles of different things that you never use. You really have to be ruthless.
Well, you do have a point about that.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I got rid of the other bottles. I just ran out of room, and they were hogging space.
And then you don't even know what you have anymore.
I would pick 3 bottles or 2 bottles you really like, and the rest.
I'm just trying to figure out a way not to waste food.
I know, because you have this French.
No, that's thing. Not just. Well, that is. That's very European.
It is.
Well, that was why I had those bottles for so long. I mean, they sat in there for a couple of years, and it pained me to get rid of them because I knew somebody could do something with them. I just didn't know what to do with them.
Be ruthless.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm going to agree.
Good.
Finally.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for your help.
Okay,
thank you.
Care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. If you'd like your cooking question answered, give us a ring anytime, 1-855-4-BOWTIE. That's 855-426-9843. You can also email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Dennis Kirschbaum from Rochester, New York.
How are you?
I am good. How are you? This is an honor and a delight.
How can we help you?
The segment that you did with the Turkish chef, Anna Sorton, and you asked her a question at the end of the segment. The gist of your question was, why is the hummus that you get in America so terrible? What she responded, which was that she thought it had a lot to do with the quality of the olive oil, really caught my attention because I'm kind of a hummus nut. And most of the hummus and the hummus recipes that I've encountered from the Middle East don't actually have any olive oil in them at all. It's used as a garnish.
There are two things. You're right, and you're in luck. My editorial director just got back from Tel Aviv 2 days ago in Palestine and spent 4 days eating and making hummus or hummus.
Oh, that's awesome.
And you're absolutely right. Olive oil is a garnish. They use very small chickpeas. They're not large like the ones we have here.
Right.
They have a lot more flavor. They also use a lot more tahini than we do here. And they have this wonderful technique of kind of swirling it in the bowl. The other thing we found, or he found, was that they serve it warm. They don't serve it room temperature. So, but you're right.
Right.
Hummus is really about the garnish because they put a lot of different things on it.
Can I just ask a question
sure.
to the two of you? Because I love hummus. I've read that it's better to start with the dried chickpeas and soak them overnight.
Yes.
But I've also read that it's a really good idea to remove the skins.
If I could talk about this for a second. If you cook the chickpeas with baking soda,
right,
it does two things. One is it makes them incredibly soft and cook faster. And it also seems to somehow dissolve the skins on the chickpeas, so you get incredibly smooth hummus without peeling.
Jason Hirsch, my editor, asked the same question because he found it to be extremely smooth. The answer is, in both Tel Aviv and Palestine, is they put it in a huge food processor and run it for about 3 minutes. So they just whip the heck out of it. Baking soda works too.
You know, if you're cooking at home, hey, I think you do have the time to skin them. So next time I make hummus, I'm going to try it. So there.
Well,
Sarah.
It's very tedious. I can
Sarah.
Tell you
you've done it, huh? You have.
Just get the food processor
out. It does
out.
Work. I
okay.
will tell you that. It does work.
Right.
But it's very, very
tedious.
I say stick with the baking soda.
Now Sarah has some homework.
Yeah, I do. Right.
Dennis, thank
well,
you so
thank
much.
You. It was really an honor talking with both of you.
Great
thank
call.
You.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Take care. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. After the break, we travel to the Baekyongsa Temple Complex in South Korea to learn about the spiritual cooking practice of Chef Jung Kwon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You know, Wonderful Pistachios have become my go-to snack. Now, I could list all the health benefits. They're a good source of protein, fiber, and unsaturated fats. But for me, flavor comes first, and that's why it's pistachios, not peanuts, in our household. Wonderful Pistachios come in a variety of flavors and sizes, including sea salt and vinegar, chili roasted, and smoked barbecue. Check out WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more. That's WonderfulPistachios.com. You know, I like classic clothing that never goes out of style, and that's why I suggest you check out Quince, an online clothing store that focuses on timeless essentials at great prices. I recently bought a Mongolian cashmere sweater for under $100. It's a great sweater and a great deal. Now that warm weather is upon us, Quince has all the seasonal must-haves, like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands by partnering directly with top factories. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. Upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/milkstreet for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/milkstreet. to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/MilkStreet.
This is Milk Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Right now, we're traveling to South Korea. We asked our Seoul-based reporter, Jason Strother, to travel a few hours south of Seoul to interview the Venerable Chung Kwan. She's a devout Zen Buddhist nun. For her, cooking is a kind of prayer, and her spiritual practice has attracted a lot of attention in the food world.
안녕하세요.
반갑습니다.
아, 반갑습니다.
안녕하세요.
예, 제이슨입니다. 예, 아, 이름은 제이슨입니다.
아, 제이슨. 네. 예,
제이슨. 예. Jason and Jung Kwan are standing on the temple property, and they stop to take a look at an ancient orange tree.
Why is this tree special?
Kwan uses the fruit to make a fermented extract, which he pours over vegetables and also salads. It clears the blood and calms you down, she says.
여기는 지금 백암선원이라 해서
Tengja tree.
The type of orange tree.
Yeah. Okay. And then it's 500 years old, which is very rare. And then in March, the flower blooms. And then in May, you can see the fruit.
I caught up with Jason later on to hear about his meeting with Chung Kwan. Hey, Jason, how are you?
Pretty good, Chris. How about you?
Pretty good. You've had more fun than I have had lately. You went to visit Chung Kwan, a very well-known Buddhist monk, and she's known a lot for her food and cooking. So tell me about it.
Right. Well, the Venerable Chung Kwan, she is really made a name for herself in the past year or so. Even a Netflix documentary series is out about her. I went down to her temple, which is a few hours south of Seoul at the Chunjinam Monastery, is where she does all her work. We took a taxi, me and my translator, up some winding streets, up into the hills. The view out over the valley was beautiful. Of course, I've been to a lot of Buddhist temples in South Korea before, but this was special.
So when you spoke to her, did you get a sense of how she connects her faith, her Buddhism, and cooking, how they're related?
Chung Kwan spoke in sort of Buddhist mantras, so it was a little hard to get all the nuances. But from what I could discern from our chat, I mean, she sees humans and food and the earth. We're all a part of the universe. So when she eats a mushroom, she is, in a sense, taking on as its essence.
Every ingredient has the spiritual energy, but especially the mushroom, it's brought up by moisture and then it grows inside the soil thanks to the energy of the nature. So it is especially valued.
Her whole process of cooking to her is sort of like meditation. She says she sees really no difference in between praying and cooking.
The joy of food and preparing food and eating food, Buddhism doesn't seem, at least in your experience with this trip, there doesn't seem to be, the joy of cooking, for example. The joy is not there in the food specifically.
Right, I think Jung Kwan and Julia Child would be on opposite ends of the spectrum for this one, Chris. No, she sees it as, it's her way of connecting with the universe, that by taking food out of the soil, she's, in a sense, giving it new life, and it's becoming a part of her to a degree.
So what did you cook? Did you cook together, or she demonstrated something? What did you cook?
One of the dishes she made was with very thin wheat noodles called somyun, and she mixed that in with gultkimchi, which is a type of cabbage. It's a leafy green vegetable that has been fermented into the ubiquitous Korean side dish kimchi. I think we all know that. So she mixed that in with the noodles, a little bit of soy sauce, stirred that around, and served cold. It was delicious.
When a person becomes monk, they learn how to cook rice so as to give the rice to the Buddha. And she also learned how to cook side dishes. Giving rice means a virtue. And then cooking side dishes is... 뭐라고 하셨죠? 그 반찬 만드는 걸 뭐라고
하죠? Side dishes. 최고.
최고?
밥 만드는 거는 공양주, 반찬 만드는 거는 최고.
최고.
그래서 반찬에서는 지혜.
아, 지혜. Well, side dishes mean like wisdom.
Get a wisdom from making 반찬.
Side dishes are considered wisdom, and rice is a virtue. That's just great.
Well, I have to say, it's fascinating to me that when you take a philosophy like Buddhism and marry it to the kitchen, the question is, does it say something to you about the nature of Buddhism, or does it say something to you about the nature of the kitchen? Mm. And so let me ask that question. Do you view cooking and preparing food differently than you did before you went to the monastery?
After visiting Jung Kwan at her temple and talking to her about food, I mean, there was just things that I never really considered before. And I realized that maybe I do frivolously think about food, that it is just something to satisfy me. It is just, I'm hungry, I eat. She looks at that as a type of greed, actually. And I think through Buddhism, she hopes to overcome that. And she also had a really interesting point about emotion in food.
화가 났을 때는 잠깐 멈춰야 합니다. 그 감정의
When you are angry, you should stop cooking. When you cook while you are angry, the emotion will be inserted in the food. And then when people eat the food, they will have the like angry character.
In Korean cuisine, a lot of dishes are fermented. Kimchi, for instance. And she sort of likened that to going to a sauna for a human, that, by sweating out the excess unnecessary moisture, you make the food more delicious and you get down to its essential flavors. And that's what fermenting is all about, which that really impressed me.
Yes, the patience is important. Fermenting some ingredients for a long time means like lowering the characters of the ingredients. Like the traits of the ingredients, like sour will be reduced. And like in order to make jangatji, which is a fermented Korean food. Like
pickled radishes.
Pickle, you mix the salt and the radish, and then if you after a long time the water of the radish will be removed. It's the same as your skin, like unnecessary moisture in your body will be removed through the sweat. So she compared the process of cooking to the human's body.
Wow, cooking is like perspiration. Wow, I never thought about it like that.
You know, I've found over the years that famous food people have their little addictions, snacks. Julia Child loved goldfish. Jim Beard loved bacon and a few other things. Did you notice anything in that kitchen where there's a little bit of a snack there? Anything that came in a foil wrap package? Or are they actually living the life they say they are?
Well, you know, Chris, I asked Jung Kwan about that. There were no visible signs of junk food or any sort of guilty pleasures. I told her to come clean, more or less. What does she snack on?
Do you have a guilty pleasure? Is there a type of food that sometimes, a fast food that sometimes you crave, or do you resist at all?
어쩌다가 에너지 떨어지면 아이스크림. 아이스크림 이제.
Ice cream, vanilla and green tea flavored. She enjoys that now and then.
Well, now I love her. Perfection's a hard thing to take for the rest of us who are far from perfect.
I'm a big meat lover, Chris. I'm going to admit it. And I told Jung Kwan that, too. I don't think she looked down on me. But I realized that, you know, after having the food at the temple, the somyeon noodles with the goat kimchi, as well as this seaweed dish she made me, as well as this nice steaming bowl of soybean stew, this doenjang jjigae. I mean, I felt really healthy and happy.
I gather there was a Buddhist parable of some kind in relation to food that she talked to you about.
That's right, Chris. I asked her, I said, is there an old Buddhist story that, concerns food? And Jung Kwan told me a little story that she likes to tell to visitors.
The parable is that before the Buddha was enlightened, he meditated and prayed for 6 years at the same place. And he didn't even eat or sleep. But then he had soup, which was a mix of rice and milk. And then he started to do the meditation again for 49 days, really hard. And then he became enlightened. So that's the origin of temple food. So in Buddhism, you should eat just as much as you need it. And you should eat with pleasure, and you should eat vegetable.
Eat with pleasure and vegetables.
Mm.
Okay. Thank you, Jason. That was fascinating. I've always been interested in Buddhism and cooking. I guess it means I can't have that old-fashioned Dunkin' Donuts I just ate for breakfast. So I have you to thank for that.
Put down the bear claw, Chris, and I'll catch you at the temple.
Okay. Thank you so much. Really, great story.
Thank you. Take care.
That was Jason Strother, a reporter based in Seoul, South Korea. John Oliver, host of Last Week Tonight, recently interviewed the Dalai Lama. Oliver, a comedian, found himself in very good company. The Dalai Lama enjoys a good laugh, especially in the face of adversity. Which makes me reconsider Jung Kwan, the Buddhist cook. She can find the meaning of the universe in a bowl of soup, but what really makes her special is that she also knows how to truly enjoy every spoonful. As the famous Buddhist parable says, don't eat too much, but be sure to eat with pleasure. This is Mill Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Right now it's time to check in with our regular contributor, Dan Pashman of the Sporkful podcast. Dan Pashman, how are you?
Good, Chris. How are you?
I'm not even going to ask you what's on your mind because I could never guess.
Well, I'm from New Jersey, Chris, and my home state has been on my mind a lot lately. So a little while back, we did an episode of the Sporkful podcast all about this iconic New Jersey food called pork roll or Taylor ham. And it's a controversial food in New Jersey because it goes by two different names depending on where in New Jersey you live. Same food. It's the same food, but people in New Jersey can't agree on what to call it. It's a processed pork, like a deli meat. It comes in a long casing. You slice it up, you get a flat circle like a slice of bologna or salami. Typically, it's fried up on a griddle or a grill. And the most iconic way to eat it in New Jersey is on an egg and cheese sandwich. Have you ever had one of these, Chris?
Can I just ask, is this pork, when you say pork product, that makes me think it's made of snouts and other odd bits of the pig? Or is this a high-quality meat?
Well, quality, see, that sounds like a subjective term, Chris.
Of course.
It is processed, okay. But, you know, I'm a nose-to-tail kind of guy.
In other words, a nose and tail kind of guy. That's probably what's in it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. This is all coming back, as you know, Chris. Now the finest restaurants in America are probably going to be serving this pork roll pretty soon because snout to tail is all the rage now.
So this is a round of a griddled pork product.
That's right. It is smoky. It is sweet. It is cured. It is in its scent similar to perhaps bacon. But in its texture, it's much meatier. It's not light and crispy. It's salty, and it's fantastic. And I think that it is the perfect companion to egg and cheese. If you do the egg over medium, so it's a little bit runny, and you get that yolk running into the melted cheese and combining with the fat and the salt, and you get, because there's also sugar in the pork roll, you get a little caramelization around the edges of the slice. It is just fantastic. And I find this food very compelling for two reasons. Well, three. Number one, it's delicious. But number two, it is an iconic food of New Jersey. Yet, number three, the people of New Jersey have been fighting about it for 150 years.
This is not a new thing.
The food has been around for 150 years. It is not a new thing. And on one hand, it is beloved in New Jersey because a lot of New Jersey is an extension of New York City. A lot of it is an extension of Philadelphia. And so there's not a whole lot of sort of pure, unadulterated New Jersey culture. And pork roll, or Taylor ham, as it's called in the North, where I'm from, is pure New Jersey. It was invented in New Jersey, in the Trenton area. The two main companies that make it are both still based in New Jersey, still owned by the same families, still making this food in New Jersey. So it is beloved, but yet the people of New Jersey can't agree on what to call it, to the point that there was a fight in the state legislature. They tried to declare a state sandwich this past year, and they couldn't agree. The bill is now stalled in committee.
because of nomenclature?
Right, because they can't agree if the official state sandwich should be pork roll egg and cheese or Taylor ham egg and cheese, even though those two sandwiches are the same sandwich.
Well, it says more about government than it does about the food.
Well, yeah, true. But then just recently, two guys in Trenton started a pork roll festival there. And they were expecting 1,000 people. They got 5,000. It was a huge success. But then even the two of them had a falling out. And now there's two dueling pork roll festivals in Trenton on the same day, every Memorial Day weekend.
So let me see if I get this right. You like this. I mean, it's delicious, yes. But you went past that quickly. You like it because it's local and people are arguing about it.
I think that it is. There's nothing else quite like it. I love it. But it's also, it's a very interesting sort of piece of local culture. There are other regions that have a food that is really specific to that place. I think that this one even stands out among many of those because people in New Jersey are so protective of the few things that are ours. You know, we got Bruce Springsteen, we got John Bon Jovi, and we got Taylor Ham. And we're going to hold on to those things.
And not in that order, by the way. Well, I guess it shows that people care deeply about it because they care so deeply they get into a fight about it. So there's passion. That's number four, right? There's passion.
Right. There's so much passion that if you marry into a New Jersey family, you will be told early on whether you're marrying into a pork roll family or a Taylor ham family. And you better well make sure you refer to it by the right name. Or you're not going to get along well with your in-laws.
That could be dangerous. Dan Pashman, thank you so much. We have a passionate story about a local pork roll, Taylor ham.
Yeah, watch it, Chris.
I'm covering both my bases. Dan, thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. After the break, more of your cooking questions with our co-host, Sarah Moulton. You know, I grew up with Vermont farmers who made do with tools they had on hand. A hammer, pliers, and baling twine, of course, for most jobs. When I became a cook, however, I found that having just the right knife or maybe the perfect carbon steel skillet made all the difference. And the right tool also added pleasure to my cooking. I truly enjoyed my time prepping as well as cooking food. And that also goes for a car. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that'll have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. And that includes available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is Milk Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. We're back with Sarah Moulton. She's going to help me take some more of your calls. Sarah, you ready?
I am ready.
Welcome to Milk Street Radio. Who's calling?
This is Kevin Friedman from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Doing well. How are you guys doing?
Good.
We're good.
How can we help you?
So I had a question about vegetables that were lower in starch. I've been on a low starch kick recently and trying to add some more veggies into my repertoire of cooking. And recently I've been messing around with turnips and kohlrabi, beets, celeriac, things like that to sort of supplement, I guess, in exchange for a white potato. Just to get more of a variety in my diet. And I'm curious to see if you guys had any ideas of how to duplicate the texture of a roasted potato, but say with one of those other vegetables.
Well, the problem is the other vegetables have a higher water content than potato, and so it's hard to get the drier, starchier texture and the crispier outside, right? I mean, that's a problem. One thing you could do is slice it into wedges, almost like fennel. Very high heat oven, coat it with oil and some salt in a bowl, lay that out on put it on a preheated roasting pan if you can, and roast at high heat. And that way you can get a lot of evaporation and you probably get a better texture. But
it's never going to be as crispy.
No.
Although, you know what, two things I want to say. One is potatoes, white potatoes get a bad rap and they really shouldn't. There's lots of nutrition in white potatoes. I know people are like, white food, throw white food out the window. But they're very high in potassium and it's just what we put on them that's a problem. So,
well, you know, rutabaga, this brings back a memory. They're very popular in Canada. We don't eat them much here. But
yeah.
We used to have something called the corner house in Vermont in summers where one Saturday night a month, there'd be a little, bachelor farmer get together. They're bachelor farmers and everybody else, and they'd sit on the couches and everyone would get together. We'd rent a movie, and unfortunately, the woman in charge of renting the movie got it from the Vermont Department of Agriculture. So we would sit there for 20 minutes watching movies on how to enjoy rutabaga.
Oh, dear.
That was the
movie.
And you
were hoping for some racy.
Well, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Okay. Some meaningful movie.
Yeah.
So you say bachelors. I'm like, what are they watching?
I've watched a lot of rutabaga movies.
Okay.
And everyone's smiling.
No, actually, I have another suggestion.
Great.
And I'm going to get Chris's idea about this one. What if you cut them into sticks, or slices,
yeah,
and then coated them in either flour, like lightly, and just sautéed them, like Wondra flour maybe, which is a little more granular, and then sautéed them to get color on them, finished them in a lower oven. But the other thing is, if you're trying to avoid flour, one of the things we've talked about a lot on the show is chickpea flour, which is ground chickpeas, which is also protein, and can give you a wonderful sort of chickpea flavor. Plus, it adds protein, and it's, you know, you're trying to eat healthy. It might be a nice thing. So I would experiment with different crumb coatings on
I think vegetables. The matchsticks are the
best way to go.
Yeah, that's
yeah
good.
Might be
good
the
idea.
Best way to go. Yeah,
Kevin,
that's
hopefully perfect. We help maybe a little bit, sort of.
I don't know, a Rutabaga movie. I just think that's in my future.
I'm not making this up.
Yeah.
A lot of fun living in Vermont.
Yes.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks.
Thank you. Take,
yeah, take care.
Okay. Hello. Welcome to Milk Street. Who do we have on the line?
This is Kim Garner from Keller, Texas.
Hi, Kim.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm great.
You have a question for us, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's just something I've always wondered about. Like, when you're following a recipe and it calls for an onion, but it doesn't specify the variety, like a white, yellow, or red, which variety should you use? Is there a rule to follow?
Well, that's an excellent
that
question.
That is a really excellent question. I would say there are some rules, but at the end of the day, if all you have is a white onion and you'd have to drive 30 miles to get a yellow onion, I wouldn't bother.
Right.
Chris, wouldn't you agree with that?
This is interesting because I do the shopping mostly on weekends. I actually like shopping because I like checking stuff out. I just buy white onions now. I find them milder in the raw state, and I also find them, oddly enough, to be in better shape because some of the yellow onions seem a little soft, not quite as good. I just like white onions, and I assume when you cook them down, well, you probably know better than I do. Is there a big difference once you cook them down?
There's a little bit of a difference. I mean, the thing about onions, it's sort of how they're grown and how much
right.
sulfur they have in them. So the same thing that makes us cry when we cut an onion is the same thing that develops into deep, wonderful flavor later on when you cook it. And the onions that generally have the most of that are the yellow storage onions, and they're grown for that reason. They're grown in soil that has more of those sulfur compounds. Hmm. They're also grown in hotter climates, and they do better with less water. So it sort of concentrates that sulfur. So that, for me, would be the onion I'd use for onion soup when you want a really
That's
deep
a good
onion
point.
Flavor.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, people think that they're low in sugar. They're actually high in sugar. They have more sugar than, say, Vidalias or any of
what?
The other. Yeah, onions, you know, the Walla Wallas, the Texas, whatever the number is, you know, those that people say you can eat raw. The reason you can eat those raw is because they are lower in sulfur, but they're also lower in sugar, interestingly enough. So I wouldn't use those as much for cooking. The red onions, it's funny because they actually are pretty high in sulfur also, but we all eat them raw, and I think it has something to do with their color, that we just like
yeah.
that. And
well,
also that when you add acid to them, they get that beautiful sort of jewel-like look.
Just slice onions, throw them in a bowl with some vinegar for 15 minutes. And
right.
that actually does a great job of getting rid of that,
that bite. You know, I think whatever onion works for you, but white onions, which also have more sulfur than the sweet Vidalias or the Walla Wallas or whatever, are used a lot in Mexican cooking and tend to be, I think, a little bit milder than the storage onions. So that's good all-purpose onion, too. And then, of course, you have scallions, which are sort of grassy and young and fresh. And
well, you know, some of the cooks at Milk Street now just keep scallions on hand as sort of an all-purpose seasoning.
Well, part of it is also you, at Milk Street, you've been traveling the globe. And so many other cultures use scallions.
Right.
And it's sort of fun, you know, to play around with a new onion. Those little onions are really, except for the ones that are like you've sat on and the chipolene, those little onions are mainly there just to use as little onions. But the chipolene have, again, more flavor, more developed
Is
sulfur.
Is it chipolene or chipolini?
Oh, I don't know, probably chipolini. So I don't know if that helps any.
But, that was interesting.
But also, I mean, at the end of the day, I think you can use any in place of another. They're all in the, what is it, the allium family.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly you'll get slightly different results.
It's a big family. Extended family. Aunts, uncles.
It's a wonderful family. We love that family.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's very interesting, and I can't wait to try some different varieties and see how my recipes turn out.
That's Sarah Moulton on Onions 101.
Love onions.
Of course,
they're so important.
That now there'll be a quiz.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you, Kim.
This is Milk Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. If you'd like your cooking question answered, give us a ring anytime. 1-855-4-BOWTIE. That's 855-426-9843. You can also email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com.
Hi, my name is Autumn White.
How can we help you?
One of the things I've been trying to do more of is make crusts and kind of things that use shortening butter or lard. And I've been trying to figure out how I can use lard. If I can substitute lard for butter, for shortening, you know, for things like in crusts, if you can use those combinations in different types, like, for example, in savory versus sweet.
Yes. The question is, what kind of lard? If it's leaf lard, which is hard to find, if you go to the supermarket, it's not leaf lard. It's the fat around the kidney of the pig, and it has no pork flavor at all. It's very neutral. And that was the original shortening used in pie crust in America. It produces the best pie crust. It's extremely flaky. So if you can get leaf lard, that's the number one thing to use in any kind of pie crust, sweet or savory.
If you want it flaky. But if you're looking for that nice flavor, you might want to do half and half butter and lard. Leaf lard, I mean.
Well, no, the best pie crust I've ever made or had is 100% leaf lard. It is just phenomenal.
But the flavor?
This is the French thing now. This
the
is
butter.
The butter.
Butter.
I usually use half butter and half Crisco.
Because Crisco gives you a flakier crust than butter.
Yeah, it does. And butter gives you some flavor. But, you know, leaf lard's great. Are you buying leaf lard or are you just buying the supermarket lard?
I probably just bought the supermarket lard. I tried actually using it yesterday and I made tamales for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I could definitely taste
the pork.
It was lard.
Yeah.
Now, I will say something, though. We just did some piadini, which is an Italian flatbread you just cook in a skillet a couple minutes aside. And we made it not with lard, just oil. And it had no flavor. And then we decided to use lard, which is what they used to use. It was fabulous. It also made a flakier, more complex bread. I think lard, you heard it here first, lard's coming back.
It is. Do you know it actually has some healthy properties, too?
Well, as opposed to what, margarine? Yeah.
No, it has omega-3s.
Oh.
Depending if the pig was fed grass and good stuff.
So, yeah, go ahead and use that or split it 50-50 with butter if you like. A little bit of lard has a lot of flavor and will make things flakier.
So. If you get the leaf lard, can you use that instead of, for example, butter in less savory recipes, like if more for dessert things?
Like, for example, what?
Like, for example, if something that calls for shortening for cookies or some kind of dessert, I mean, would you be able to substitute it if it doesn't have flavor then and it would have the same property?
You're not going
to
make butter cookies with leaf lard. Then you have lard cookies. I think pastry is really the best thing to use it for, would be the ideal. Bread, pastry, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Where you're not looking for the flavor of the butter.
Yeah. And I mean, the leaf lard, by the way, has to be rendered. So if you can buy rendered leaf lard, which means it's cooked very low heat.
It takes a long time to render it.
It's a few hours, small pieces, a little bit of water. So you want to buy rendered leaf lard.
Okay, I'll have to start looking.
Okay.
And regular lard is great for savory applications if you don't use too much of it.
Right.
And one last thing, can you use bacon grease if you don't have lard as a substitution if you don't mind the bacon flavor?
I would definitely try to strain it out a little bit, but yeah, you could use that.
Yeah, but it will be very porky.
You want to use just a little bit of it.
Yeah.
Give it a shot and try to find rendered leaf lard because that's just a wonderful thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay,
all right. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. This week's Milk Street Basic is all about freezing rice. You know, many recipes call for leftover rice, like the fried rice recipe we did this week. And it turns out that freshly made rice is really no good for those recipes. It's too starchy and too soft. So the question is, how do you make and store leftovers? Well, it's actually simple. With the leftover rice, place it in a Ziploc bag and just put it in the freezer. You can defrost it on the countertop or even in a microwave. Now you can produce dinner in just minutes. Stir-fried rice, a quick rice soup maybe, or maybe for use in a quesadilla. Here at Milk Street, we like to make double batches of rice, so we always have leftovers on hand. Now it's time to talk to Belgian food blogger and author Regula Isewyn. In her new cookbook, Pride in Pudding, Isewyn researches the history of pudding in British culture going all the way back to the 14th century, from pease pudding and haggis through jam roly-poly, plum duff, and spotted dick. Welcome to Milk Street.
Thank you.
Well, I love your book, and, you know, I love any kind of pudding. So let's go way back in time and talk about puddings. You reminded me that in Homer, in the Odyssey, Odysseus comes home, and there was a black pudding cooked in a goat's stomach, which I guess is part of the definition of a pudding, right? Early on, they were almost stuffings, right? They were stuffed into whole animals,
yes,
or stuffed into the stomachs of animals or the intestines. Essentially, they're almost sausages, right, of some kind.
Yes, you totally beat me to it. If you want to know what a pudding is, you have to go back to the Middle Ages when the word pudding actually meant the insides of an animal or a human. Puddings were back then just exclusively made into animal guts, stomachs, even uterus, and, you know, sausage intestines. So, you know, it was a custom in that period to name things after how they looked, or in this case, in which recipient they were prepared. So after a while, pudding became synonymous for the filling, and puddings were being made in earthenware pots, pudding cloths, and after a while, the name pudding became the name for the mass, the filling, the batter.
Now, you also mentioned, this was interesting, that it was almost a one-pot meal, so people boiled everything because that was the obviously easiest way of cooking and most efficient. And so you might have a joint, let's say, or something, a rabbit or something in the water, but you might also throw in a pudding so you could cook the pudding at the same time as you cook the meat. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. In the past, they would only have one big cauldron on their fire. They didn't have pots and pans and all kinds of little utensils. They only had that big cauldron. So they would have been preparing their main meal, which is usually a stew or a pottage. And they would use those bag-like intestines to create a side dish. And that way, they had something extra. And they would hang that in with the rest of the food being cooked. And I think that's my theory, because those are smaller portions, you know, in a small bag, they would have taken better care of the seasoning and probably taken more time to actually prepare those puddings, which is why probably they became such a favorite, because you can see through the ages that pudding is such an absolute favorite.
So I wanted to talk about sweet and sugar. Sugar was a very expensive ingredient in America until later in the 19th century. There was honey, there was preserved fruits and things. When did puddings start becoming really sweet? Was it related to the cost of sugar, or was it something else?
It was definitely related to the cost of sugar and the availability. And it was also because our taste changed. We use so much more sugar today than we use in the past. And it was something that only started to become more sweet end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century. Then people would have started to add more sugar, and puddings started to become exclusively sweet dishes as well.
Tell me about the use of the pudding cloth. There were, you know, bowls and stuff originally, I guess, or then intestines or stomachs. It was just because it was more convenient to use?
Well, my theory is that people really loved pudding so much that they would have been longing for a way to make pudding outside of the slaughter season. Because basically when they would have made pudding, they would have needed bag-like intestines. So they would have needed an animal. So they could not make it outside of the slaughter season. So people would have been looking at ways to still create pudding-like dishes without using an animal intestine to stuff it in. So very early on, they actually started using a cloth. The first time it appeared in a manuscript is very early 15th century.
You have different kinds, a lot of different kinds of puddings, and one of them was a Bakewell pudding. And I didn't know anything about this. I'd heard the term. It's a puff pastry shell filled with custard, at least in this case. So could you just talk about the range of things that are called puddings? Because it's a very generic term. It just means dessert almost, right?
True. Yes. Today, pudding is basically a word for dessert. But there are so many puddings, and there are still savory puddings eaten in the UK as well. So it is something quite ambiguous. But we have boiled puddings, and they still exist, which are types of like haggis, black pudding, white pudding. And then you have the baked puddings, which are, like you said, the Bakewell pudding, which is using either an earthenware recipient or a tart casing or a pastry casing, which encloses the pudding batter. Or fried puddings, batter puddings is another word, which is going into the Yorkshire pudding. Or the English also had this pudding, which was called a syringe fritter. And a churros or a churrera is a syringe. So it is very interesting to see that all over Europe, we have these very similar and sometimes identical puddings, like blancmange appears in all European cookery books as well.
So I guess my question for you is, I love the book. It has a very beautiful, for people who love books, it's one of those books that has weight. It could have been a book that's a classic book from the 19th or 18th century. It just has that feel to it. But are there one or two recipes you actually continue to make on a sort of regular basis that makes sense to cook now that you love?
I make the Bakewell pudding on a very regular occasion. It is a very interesting pudding sweet. It's not prepared today as it is in the past, because in the past it was made with bitter almonds, which are poisonous. So today you would use apricot kernels, which are still a little bit poisonous, but it's okay. You probably won't feel much from it. But what is interesting with that is that bashing the apricot kernels with rose water creates the scent and flavor of marzipan. And it's absolute magic when that happens, when the nuts release their oil and it mixes with rose water. It's just the beautiful smell just puffs up out of your pestle and mortar. It's gorgeous. And that you mix with butter and eggs and sugar, and that becomes your filling, which goes on top of your pastry casing and strips of candied citron or lemon or orange and some raspberry preserve. Mm. And then on top of that goes that custardy filling, and that's baked in the oven. And it creates the most glorious pudding.
Regular, thank you so much. It's a lovely book, Pride in Pudding, and I'm going to go make the Bakewell pudding as soon as I can.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much for inviting me.
That was Regula Isawyn, author of the cookbook Pride in Pudding. As Shakespeare wrote, a rose by any other name, meaning, of course, that a name does not convey the essence of the thing itself. Now, I would argue that the names of English puddings are exceptions. The names are, in fact, the things themselves. So would Dead Man's Arm be the same if it were called Boiled Jam Roly-Poly? Or take Flummery, which was originally made of boiled oats. The name is much better than the dessert. So names really do matter, even if one is more afraid of sticks and stones. Thanks for listening to Milk Street Radio. You can listen to our weekly shows on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Spotify. You can also get our shows on our very own website. That's milkstreetradio.com, where you can download each week's recipe. We'll be back next week.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with WGBH. Executive producers Melissa Baldino and Stephanie Stender. Producer Amy Padula. Production assistant Carly Helmuttag. Senior audio engineer Douglas Sugars. Senior audio editor Melissa Allison, with help from Vicky Merrick and Sydney Lewis. Audio mixing by Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media. Production help Debbie Paddock. Theme music by Tubob Crew. Additional music by George Brandel Eggroth. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.